America at a Crossroads is a weekly live webinar series that brings together journalists, scholars, thought leaders, and policymakers for discussions regarding the state of American democracy, where we've been, where we are, and where we're going. The series was jointly founded by Jews United for Democracy and Justice and Community Advocates, Inc. To register for our live webinars, join our email list at JewsUnitedForDemocracy.org.
These are very short introductions of people whose CVs are a mile long. In the interest of giving our guests maximum amount of time, I'm going to abbreviate their introductions and ask them for forgiveness for leaving so many important things out. Yossi Klein Halevi is an American-born Israeli. He is a senior fellow at the Shalom Hartman Institute in Jerusalem, where he co-directs the Institute's Muslim Leadership Initiative, which teaches emerging young Muslim American leaders about Judaism, Jewish identity, and Israel. Yossi is a prolific essayist and columnist and a best-selling author. His most recent book, Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor, is a New York Times bestseller. He is an important thought leader for both American Jews and Israelis. David Wolpe, Rabbi David Wolpe, is a visiting scholar at Harvard Divinity School and the Max Webb Emeritus Rabbi of Sinai Temple in West Los Angeles, having just earned that emeritus title within the last few months. He previously taught at the Jewish Theological Seminary in New York and the American Jewish University in Los Angeles. He's taught at Hunter College, UCLA, and many other institutions. He has been named the most influential rabbi in America, and he now serves as the inaugural rabbinic fellow, for the Anti-Defamation League. We now thank both of our guests and hand the program over to David Wolpe. Rabbi?
Thank you. So it is a great pleasure to be able to be in dialogue with Yossi Klein Halevi, who is, I think, an enormously important source of both insight and wisdom for the Israeli and American and worldwide Jewish communities and beyond. So Yossi, I'm happy to virtually see you and to be able to ask you about the thing that we're thinking about night and day. And I'm going to start just by asking, how different is the atmosphere in Israel today from what it was a little more than a week ago.
Well, first of all, David, it's an honor to be in dialogue with you. And ever since this was arranged, I've been really looking forward to this. So thank you. Thank you for doing this. You know, I've known Israel at peak moments and at moments of near despair. I made Aliyah into the first Lebanon War in the summer of 1982, a couple of weeks before the Sabra and Shatila massacre. I was raising two teenage children during the Second Intifada. It was 4 years of suicide bombings. But nothing has compared to what we're experiencing now, because it's hit us on so many different levels. You know, first of all, there's the shock. Where was the army? How could this have happened? Literally 50 years to the anniversary of the Yom Kippur War, when the whole country was asking the question, how could it have happened then? It happens. It happens now. On the level of the mass murder, you know, we lost 1,000 Israelis in 4 years of suicide bombings during the Second Intifada. We lost 1,400 people in one day. The Second Intifada transformed Israeli politics for a generation. It essentially destroyed the Israeli left. What impact is this going to have politically, spiritually, culturally? And I think most of all, for me, what really hit hardest, and I think this is true for many people here, wasn't just the massacre. It wasn't even only the atrocities. It was the fact that hundreds of Jews, Israelis, were murdered with their hands bound behind their backs. That's something that is so antithetical to the Israeli ethos that it negates everything about what we thought we were doing here. We were creating a refuge for the Jewish people. We were teaching the Jews how to defend themselves. And never again didn't mean that Jews would never again be killed, but they would never again be killed that way, helplessly. And so we're reeling, you know, and this is one of those rare historic moments that you know while they're happening immediately that nothing is ever going to be the same again. I don't know what that means, but that's the sense here. And then when you factor in that we haven't even begun the war yet.
Right.
And we're about to experience a nightmare in Gaza. And we're about to test the support of our friends to the limit. Because terrible images are going to be coming from Gaza in the coming weeks. Stomach-turning images. And so there's such a convergence of emotions and fears and anger that it's hard to sort out.
So I'm going to ask you to be a historian, a pundit, and a prophet. I've asked you about past, present, and future. I want to start, because you mentioned the images that are about to come from Gaza, to ask you, several people have made the case that Israel will lose more by going into Gaza on a ground war than they would by stopping the bombing and not going in. So do you believe that it is inevitable that Israel go in? And if so, why?
Yeah, I do, and I'll explain why in a moment. But it's interesting that the people who tend to give us well-intentioned advice, and much of that advice is coming from friends, coming from people who really care about Israel. Tom Friedman, for example, has certainly proven how much Israel means to him. And they never or almost never offer us an alternative. You can call this Israel's 9/11. You can call it our Pearl Harbor. If we don't respond, and this is why I believe it is inevitable that we will respond, if we don't respond proportionally, and by proportionally I mean in direct proportion to the blow to our deterrence, to our military credibility, then we are on our way to becoming a failed country. Our neighbors are taking note. If we don't respond strongly, we are going to be inviting aggression from Hezbollah, from Syria, and of course, ultimately, all of this is coming from Iran. So that's one crucial piece of this. There's another, no less important point here, which is a very large number of Israelis are quietly asking themselves the question, is it over? Do we still have the right stuff? Do we still have what it takes to defend the only non-Arab, non-Muslim country for thousands of kilometers around us? Or have we lost our nerve? Did the tightrope walker look down? This is a tightrope walker losing his balance moment. And everybody's watching. And if we don't reassert our balance, our metaphorical balance, and literally the balance of power in the region, many Israelis are going to conclude this is no place to raise a family. And I'm hearing this from young people. Can we really, after Israel is now the most dangerous country in the world for Jews? Israel is the country where Jews have been least protected. Now, that's a stunning historic moment. And to tell us that we need to be mindful of the Gaza quagmire, which is certainly true, to tell us that this will be a nightmare of civilian casualties, God forbid, but it's certainly a possibility. And not offer us an alternative, a credible way of reestablishing our deterrence, is essentially to say this is the beginning of the decline of the Jewish state. And we all know it. And that's why this war has support from almost everyone, from left to center to right. I read a terrific article in one of the Hebrew papers the other day by Yuval Noah Harari, who's our resident Buddhist.
Right.
And he writes with such, I won't even call it rage, but determination. This is a moment where we are confronting absolute evil. And if we blink, then we're going to lose our ability to defend ourselves. That's what's at stake here.
So a question or two about the past before we get to the present and future. How did we get here? That is, how much of this do you attribute to the internal workings of the Palestinians and the Arab world and Iran? How much of it is a function of divisions in Israel and even Israel's policy toward the Palestinians in terms of trying to create different leadership groups, bolstering Hamas sometimes to diminish the Palestinian Authority, the whole constellation of policies. We're not obviously going to go through one by one, but any way that you want to frame that.
Look, I think that there's a lot of blame to go around here, but certainly Israel didn't create Hamas. Netanyahu over the years has strengthened Hamas in ways for which he's going to have to answer to a future commission of inquiry. And in all likelihood, that's what's going to bring him down. Although there are so many other issues that should be bringing him down. But the blame for Hamas belongs with the Palestinian people. Hamas was voted in elections in Gaza. And there are limits to the ways in which the Palestinian people can evade responsibility for their leadership. And it was always astonishing to me. And I used to ask Palestinian friends about this. I said, how is it possible that you've created only two political options in Palestinian politics? It's either a fundamentally corrupt Palestinian Authority, or it's an ideologically corrupt Hamas. Where is the Palestinian middle class? Where is the middle ground? And I know the middle ground exists in Palestinian society. So there's a lot to answer on their side. On our side, it's really hard to know where to begin. There certainly has been a systematic downplaying of the significance of the Palestinian issue. We've pretended that we can manage the issue until it blew up in our faces. And successive governments have been party to that illusion, which is now over. I would say that a major role, major responsibility belongs to the Netanyahu government of the last year. We were warning, and by we, I say those of us who are out on the streets week after week for the last 10 months, warning the Netanyahu government, this is going to lead to disaster. Now, of course, none of us knew exactly how this would play out. But the fact that this last year of divisiveness, of hatred coming from Netanyahu and his ministers, of destroying one ministry after another and replacing qualified civil servants with party hacks, destroying the Israeli civil service, trying to destroy the Supreme Court, to make the court subservient to the prime minister, and on, with the army warning Netanyahu repeatedly that by pursuing, single-mindedly pursuing the judicial program, as if that's what really mattered for Israel's future, more than anything else, to rein in activist judges. You look back on it now and we don't need historians in the future. We look back on what Israel was 3 weeks ago with total disbelief. This is what Netanyahu, the prime minister, was doing for the last year, trying to destroy the judiciary. And so when this blew up in our faces, the shock, of course, was the way in which it happened. But the fact that Netanyahu has led us to the worst disaster in the country's history, that's the natural culmination of what this last year has been like.
So first of all, there is a link now to the Harari article that's been posted in the chat, and you can take a look at it later. I remember many years ago, Wendy Mogul wrote a book about your kids, and I called her and said, I want you to come to the synagogue and speak about your book, The Blessings of a B+. And she said, David, it's called The Blessings of a B-. But me being an optimist, I had made her book better than it was, which shows like who I am. And right before the chat, I was talking to you about a book that I have not only read, but given out numerous times. And I called it Letters to My Palestinian Friend, when it's actually called Letters to My Palestinian Neighbor. And I realized I pulled a Wendy Mogul on you. But I think that actually in that mistake that I made is a significant question, which is, you said you know that the Palestinians have a middle class, and you've obviously spent a lot of time, more than almost any American and more than most Israelis by far, talking to Palestinians and trying to understand their culture and society. Do you think you have a partner for peace there? Does this prove that you don't?
Look, I know that I have partners for peace, and I always knew that, and that's still true. The question is, how significant are these people? How much do they represent those who perhaps have less courage to speak out than they do? My assumption is that for every Palestinian who dares to speak out about normalizing relations with Israel, there are many more who have been cowed into silence. But at a certain point, the question becomes irrelevant if there isn't a public presence. And, you know, when I wrote the book, I was looking for, and I said this in the book, I'm looking for a few Palestinians with whom to model a conversation with, a conversation about irreconcilable narratives. Let's not avoid our narratives. Let's actually go right to what divides us. And I found those partners, and I never allowed myself until now, until the last 2 weeks, to ask myself the question you've just asked me. And I didn't allow myself to ask that because, first of all, I felt it wasn't fair to those courageous Palestinians who stepped up and were my partners, responded to the book, wrote fantastic letters, and allowed me to publish their letters in a later edition. And I appeared with some of these people publicly. And so I felt that I'm just a writer, I'm just a citizen, I can't make peace. I found some people with whom to model a new kind of conversation with. And it was a Dayeno moment, you know, that was it. That was all, that's what I was able to do, and that's what was fulfilled. If you ask me today, do I think we have partners in the Palestinian movement? And I would broaden the question to include the Arab world, the Muslim American community, which I've spent a lot of time working with through the Shalom Hartman program, the Muslim Leadership Initiative. Right now, I see a colossal moral failure in virtually the entire Muslim world. A few months ago, a few dozen settlers burned several dozen Palestinian homes in Hawara. We all remember it. And one of the reasons we all remember it is because there were many voices in Israel who spoke up. And I condemned it as a pogrom, and some Jews were very angry at me. How dare you borrow language from Jewish history? And I thought, well, this is happening on our watch. And I didn't say, you know, two Jewish boys were just murdered by terrorists this morning, and that's why they went on a rampage. I didn't talk about that. Nobody who condemned the pogrom in Hawara mentioned the two boys who had been murdered that day by Palestinian terrorists. But how much if and but and equivocating did we hear among those few people who did come out and condemn? So this is a moment, as somebody who really has devoted a good part of my life to Muslim-Jewish relations, to Palestinian-Israeli relations, and I believe we have no choice, because the day after this war, we're all going to wake up into the same Middle East, Palestinians, Israelis, Saudis. We're all stuck with each other. But this is a moment to acknowledge that something fundamental didn't happen. And that's going to impact how, I think, how we need to engage with the Muslim world.
So I'm not
so
going
it's,
to...
So it's beyond the Palestinians. It includes the Palestinians.
I'm not going to spend a lot of time on the American scene, because you have a special expertise to lend us on what's going on in Israel, and I want to exploit that. But I think the disappointment that you're talking about is a disappointment that right now is shuddering through the American left, the Jewish left, when they don't hear those that they thought were their allies expressing, even expressing sympathy, sometimes even with qualifications. And it's been a shock to the system on the progressive left not to hear that. So, okay. Now, what's going to happen now? Let's move from being the historian to being the pundit. First of all, do you have confidence in the new coalition government with the Gallant and Golant and Netanyahu all together, with Gantz and Golant and Netanyahu?
I think that if Gantz and Eisenkot, who is a former IDF commander-in-chief, who came in with Gantz, weren't sitting there today, I would be frantic. As it is, we have never gone to war with so many Israelis having such little faith in our leadership. I think Netanyahu deserves to be run out of town. And the fact that he apparently will be leading us into war is stunning to me. But thank God we've got some balance now in the government with Gantz's centrist party. Like many Israelis, I will be watching every step that Netanyahu makes. And you know, when I say that we've never gone to war with such little trust in our leadership, I mentioned earlier that I moved to Israel at the beginning of the first Lebanon War. And there was a deep rupture between the leadership, between Prime Minister Menachem Begin and Defense Minister Ariel Sharon, and much of the country, which did not believe in the justness of Israel's invasion of Lebanon. But no one doubted for a moment that Begin and Sharon put the interests of the country before their personal interests. I can't say that I have that faith today. And yet, what we're discovering about ourselves, about our capacity as Israelis for compartmentalization. I can have the sense of almost uncontrollable rage against Netanyahu and this government on the one hand, and on the other hand, find myself without any difficulty uniting, linking arms with his voters. If you had told me 3 weeks ago that we would pivot from a point of near civil war to one of the peak moments of national unity, I don't think I would have believed we had the ability to do that. And so here we are in this place of truly inspiring national unity with a leadership that I have less than zero faith in. I fear this leadership. But, you know, in Hebrew we say zemayesh. That's what we've got. And what we really have is the Jewish people. And the Jewish people is back. It's back in Israel, and it's back in the diaspora. And it's an extraordinary moment. I think we're going to need to ask ourselves the hard question when this is over, whether we can really continue to be a dysfunctional people in the intervals between massacres of Jews, and whether there's something about this moment that we can carry into the post-war period.
So you go into Gaza. Let's say that the operation, however horrible in terms of PR, and we can talk about PR in a moment, is successful. What then, what follows? What's the after game?
Well, the question really is what happens in the course of the war. This is the first war that Israel is ever going into where we know who we're fighting at the beginning, and we don't know who we're going to be fighting at the end. If you think about it, the Six-Day War, we knew exactly what the lineup was, Yom Kippur, Lebanon. This time, we're going in to fight Hamas. We could find ourselves in a war with Hezbollah and ultimately with Iran. So there are so many wild cards here. Assuming that we manage to get through a one-front war, and I think the irony here is that the more successful we will be against Hamas, the more likely that there will be another front opening up.
Mm.
So we don't even know. Even if it's just against Hamas, there are so many variables.
Right.
Is the army really ready to fight this kind of house-to-house war? I have to believe that we are. Despite what we saw 3 weeks ago, I have to believe that the army can do it. It's the only army I have. And so what we are doing is laying aside not only our fear of our leaders in leadership incompetence, we're also putting aside our fears of whether the army is up for it. And we're just going to say we are trusting the army as if we believe it's able to do it, as if October 7th didn't happen. So if the army can do it, if the army manages to succeed in defeating Hamas without creating inadvertent atrocities, the kind of atrocity that the world media thought had happened last week and didn't. But the more deeply we go into Gaza, the more likely that something like that will happen.
Yes.
By accident, but still. And so there's so many variables here. And you know, David, one of the things that worries me the most is will our friends, including diaspora Jews, be able to continue to support us? I think that the Israeli public, by and large, is in it to the end. We realize there's no choice. I regard almost regardless of what happens. I don't have that same confidence that many of our friends, including parts of the diaspora, and I'm speaking about those parts of the diaspora that are with us. I'm not talking about the fringes. It's going to be really tough going, and we're going to need a kind of courage that I would call a terrible courage. The courage to know that we're fighting evil, and there will be horrifying scenes, and it will require of us a kind of courage that we're not used to.
I, as you can imagine, many of the questions that we've gotten are exactly on that theme. You know, since the PR war is already a struggle and it's only a week later, what happens, as you say, when Israel goes into Gaza and day after day after day, there is this pounding and punishing series of images, as there inevitably will be. And also what happens if a second front opens in the north. And right now, it has not happened yet. I don't know why, but I would love it if you would. This is what both Livia and Eric asked in different iterations. Do you think a second front will open in the north? And do you think that Israel can withstand the PR barrage against it, especially if opinion starts to move in the United States? Right now, by the way, the polls are still showing overwhelming support for Israel in the United States.
You know, Benny Gantz said recently that this operation, or it's not an operation, it's a war, can take many months. We don't have many months.
Right.
And every war that we've ever fought proved that. The Yom Kippur War ended just as Israel had the upper hand. And this time, my sense is that the consensus among Israelis, the consensus within the political class, within the security establishment, is we're going to the end. And that is going to leave a great deal of damage, to say nothing of damage in Gaza, damage to our relationships around the world. Again, we are straining the goodwill of our friends to the limits. And I think that we have no choice. This is one of those moments that define a country's resolve. And as far as the second front goes, in a way, Hamas is a sideshow. One of the reasons why October 7th is such a devastating blow to Israel's credibility is because Hamas is the least powerful of our enemies. They were the enemy that we always dismiss. Hezbollah is the real force to contend with. And Iranian revolutionary bases in Syria. You know, Iran's greatest achievement was to encircle Israel. Iran is on almost every one of our borders. And so the question here really is, you know, I said earlier that the more successful we are against Hamas, the more likely a second or even third front. And the reason for that is can Iran afford to be exposed as an untrustworthy patron? And my sense is that there's a very delicate balance of threat happening right now. America is threatening Lebanon, is threatening Hezbollah with an aircraft carrier off the coast. That's a very important development. There's a very complicated balance of threat and deterrence. We need to reclaim our deterrence. Iran needs to prove that its deterrence is in place, so that if one of its clients is being destroyed, and we intend to destroy the Hamas regime, Iran may be forced to intervene. In Lebanon itself, you have a very complicated balance of fear. There's tremendous pressure within the Lebanese public not to drag Lebanon into another war. The memories of 2006 are still very raw in Lebanese society. And Israel has made clear that if Hezbollah attacks us, we will hold Lebanon directly responsible. We will destroy the Lebanese infrastructure. What is happening now in Gaza will happen in southern Lebanon. The army has been saying that for years, that what Israel will do is tell all the civilians in southern Lebanon to leave and then we will destroy Hezbollah. Now, we're talking about, there's something else that I think, you know, I just want to step back for a moment. Because what's happened to the conflict, the Middle Eastern conflict, in the last, I would say, 35 years, since the first Gulf War in 1991, what's happened is that the home front became the actual front. So in the Gulf War, we all huddled in our sealed rooms while Saddam Hussein sent missiles to us. Then you had the Second Intifada, where civilian Israel was the battleground for 4 years. And then in 2006, a war with Hezbollah, it was the IDF against Hezbollah, but the bulk of the war was happening aimed at the Israeli front. Tens of thousands of missiles being fired. And so what's happening now, this is the ultimate war of their home front and our home front. It's civilians who are on the front lines on both sides.
So, as you say, in so many ways, that makes this an almost impossible war to win in the ways that you want to win, which is both on the military front and on the public front. We know that it is given to other nations to fight wars of tremendous destruction like Russia, and they don't care what the world says about them, essentially.
Or the U.S., or David, the U.S. fighting ISIS in Raqqa.
Right, exactly. Mm-hmm. I always used to say to people when they were trying to understand the Middle East, I would say to them, what do you think the U.S. would do if Khomeini took over Texas? Just to give them a sense of, like, we know what the U.S. would. There would be no Texas tomorrow. It would be gone. But Israel does not have that. I mean, for all we can complain and talk about it, Israel does not have that latitude, and we know it. So I want to get a sense of the sacrifices that will inevitably be made here. Do you think the Abraham Accords are gone? And do you think Saudi Arabia is gone?
I think that the Saudis are furious at Israel, not because we're pounding Gaza, but because we allowed ourselves to be perceived as weak.
Mm.
The Saudis and the Abraham Accords, the Saudis and the Gulf states, turned to Israel because we were perceived to be strong.
Right.
Militarily and also economically. We were seen as a successful society. And I heard that from people in the Gulf. You know, it's not only that we're looking to Israel as a buffer against Iran. We're looking at a new Middle East that'll be divided between failed states and successful states. And Israel's the most successful state in the region. And that's, you are part of the alliance of an emerging Middle East. The right. Tremendous blow of October 7 was to this idea of an emerging Arab-Israeli alliance based on Israeli strength. So I think the Saudis are furious with us, but it has nothing to do with what we're doing in Gaza. And I would guess the same is true in the Gulf states.
And do you think that they will be able to withstand what some call the Arab Street and stay in the Accords?
You know, I was in Morocco about half a year ago, and I walked around with a kippah, and I told people that I feel safer here than I would in Paris or London, or for that matter, Brooklyn. And there was so much goodwill toward Israelis that I experienced. I'm afraid to know what they're thinking now, what they're saying now. I think that the paradox here is that the only way to preserve Israel's credibility as a strong country is to do those kinds of decisive steps that will inflame the Arab street. In other words, the Arab political elite needs us to reclaim our strategic credibility. But that's exactly what will inflame the street. So there again, we're looking at very delicate balance of power.
So we have a question from David A., who wants to know, what's the impact of the past 2 weeks and what's coming next on Israel's economy?
Well, one of the things that's interesting is we have a very large army massed both in the north and the south. Something like 350,000 people have been called up. And the Israel that I moved to 40 years ago would have been crippled by that kind of mass call-up. In fact, it was. At the first Lebanon war, the economy basically came to a standstill. We're now a country of almost 10 million people. And certainly the economy is being hit hard, but it's still functioning. And I've never seen this before in war, certainly not in a major war in Israel. So how much longer are we going to be able to withstand this? Look, I think that the greatest danger to the Israeli economy was the threat to Israeli democracy. And that would have destroyed the Israeli high-tech sector. The democratic movement won. I mean, we won in the worst possible way, but it's over. The judicial coup has failed.
Yeah.
And in that sense, Israeli democracy, I believe, will remain intact. And so the Israeli economy will be able to recover. Imagine if there hadn't been a democratic movement and Netanyahu and his partners would have been allowed to effectively destroy Israeli democracy. Imagine where we would be today. And so I feel this enormous sense of gratitude to the protest movement, which also, by the way, has made it possible for Israelis across the political spectrum to join together. If we were no longer a democracy, I don't know if liberal Israelis would really be rallying around the flag the way everyone is today. So my sense about the Israeli economy is really what I would say to you as well about Israeli society. We are far more intact today than we were 3 weeks ago. And yes, the economy is going to take inevitably a tremendous hit. But I think Israeli resilience is back.
Since you have been grappling with really difficult questions, I'm not going to hold back from a really difficult question, which is, okay, right now, all of a sudden, I wave a magic wand and I give you plenipotentiary power over the Israeli military and diplomatic corps. What do you do about the hostages? How much give do you have? Famously traded thousands of people for Gilad Shalit. Obviously, everybody is saying perhaps that was a mistake. Maybe that gave a precedent that was injurious to Israel's long-term health. What do you do and how should we think about the hostages other than obviously with tremendous fear and compassion?
The whole country is being held hostage. That's what's different now. In the past, Hamas had Palestinian human shields. Now they have Israeli human shields as well. My sense is, and no one is saying this out loud, because it's too terrible. But my sense is that the determination to go to the end includes all consequences. I saw an interview the other day with the IDF's chief spokesperson, Jonathan Conricus, who's actually been terrific. It's just been first rate. And he was asked, I think it was Anderson Cooper, said, will the presence of Israeli hostages impede the maneuverability of the IDF. And he said, the IDF is committed to destroying Hamas's military capability. That was his answer. It was a non-answer, but it was very much an answer. It's a terrible answer. But I think that one of the unbearable consequences of October 7th is that all the ground rules have changed. And I remember, you know, I wrote an article after Gilad Shalit, you know, the self-congratulatory Jewish kind of article where we pat ourselves on the back. Look what a great people we are. We care so much about life. Look at
I've never done that.
Yeah, I know.
Anything like that. Never.
Well, that's it. Well, that's why you're the rabbi we look up to.
Right.
But the rest of us did, David. The rest of us certainly did.
I did a couple of them. I know it's true. Yeah.
And now we look back and we say, you know, sometimes being warm and soft and enables evil, empowers evil. And how many of the people who we released were actively involved in the massacre? And so we're not going there anymore.
No.
This is an extreme case. We haven't been in anything like this. I mean, you know, the closest that comes to it was the Entebbe hijacking, right, where there were about 100 Israelis held prisoner. And we know the lengths we went to save them. How do you save hostages who are spread all through Gaza and in all likelihood are hidden in those tunnels which we intend to attack? Do we not attack the tunnels if we know they're there?
Look, I
won't answer the question.
You know as well as I do the line from the Midrash arising from Saul and Agag, that those who are compassionate to the cruel will end up being cruel to the compassionate. And it's a very, very difficult calculation, but it's one that Israel faces right now.
Yes.
So you are in the unique position. There are only a few of you who really know Israel and really know the United States. So speak to American Jews. What do we need to hear and what do we need to be saying? This is a question that's been asked by several people, but David had asked it among others. Help us, like, how to think about this and what to do if we want to help.
Look, this is an unbearable position for diaspora Jews generally. I think it's going to be really hard for American Jews. It's going to be harder for smaller diaspora communities. Think of the Jews in England. Think of what's going on in the streets in England today. Hundreds of thousands of people demonstrating for Hamas. And to have to stand up and say we support Israel when much of liberal or progressive opinion is saying Israel is committing genocide. Israel is asking diaspora Jews to stand with us at a time when we will be implicating you in the charge of genocide.
Right.
We've never been in a situation quite like this before. So it's going to require an enormous amount of courage. I go back to the phrase, terrible courage. And what it means, first of all, is to stand up and speak the truth. That's first of all. There are times when evil is so outrageous, is so shameless, that the only way to confront it is by destroying it. And that's what this moment is. And that means speaking a language that liberal American Jews are not used to. Liberal American Jews, when you speak of Tikkun Olam, you mean enhancing the good. But there's another side to Tikkun Olam, which is limiting evil, preventing the reach of evil. And American Jews specialize in the first kind of Tikkun Olam, Israel specializes in the second. And this is a moment for American Jews to be adopting Israeli tikkun olam, of really having that backbone and standing up to evil. What exactly that means, how American Jews should respond, look, I think that Israel, as I do to some extent know the American Jewish community because I've maintained a tactile relationship with the community for these last 40 years. I'm on the JFK Ben-Gurion line. But even so, I don't really know the community. And I don't, you know, one thing that I do know about American Jews is that when they commit to something, they figure out what to do. There's no better organized community, Jewish community. There's no community of smarter and more capable people. And I really mean that. And I'm not going to presume to tell you what to do. I can suggest what the framework is, which is we need to start speaking a different language. And it also needs to be a language without apology. This is one of those moments in Jewish history when there's no room for equivocating.
Please
go ahead.
I was going to say that one of the differences between the Israeli mentality and the American mentality is American Jews have specialized in trying to figure out how not to be hated. We spent a lot of time and energy and organizational energy and so on. And it may not be possible to support this war and not have many people feel very negatively about Jews. And that's going to be extremely difficult. And I don't know how in Israel or in America, that's going to scramble the usual divisions of right and left, but they're going to get scrambled.
I think that's a terrific insight because in Israel, we're just used to being hated. And if you think about the American Jewish experience as opposed to the Israeli experience, your experience is living in a society, and this is still true despite everything, where Jews are liked, are admired, are embraced, are married. And so the American Jewish response, the justified response was to create forms of Judaism, of Jewishness, that's flexible, that's embracing of the wider society. In Israel, we've dealt with the exact opposite environment, an environment of relentless hostility. And so our response to the environment was deterrence, not embrace. And now these two modes of Jewish adaptability to very different circumstances are coming into tension.
Yeah. So we only have a few minutes left, and I want to ask you, what gives you hope? Because I think you have been like both eloquent and unsparing in the dilemmas that Israel faces, that world Jewry faces, that I would also say, by the way, people of goodwill who love freedom and democracy face, because I really do think this is a civilizational struggle and Israel is the tip of the spear. But what gives you hope right now when you look around at this situation?
First of all, the reemergence of Jewish unity, however fragile, however temporary. As I said before, 3 weeks ago, this moment was inconceivable. I was getting to the point where I wasn't sure that we would ever be able to come together again, no matter the threat. And we've been there before in Jewish history. We've experienced in the Warsaw Ghetto. We don't have to go back to the Roman siege of Jerusalem. In the Warsaw Ghetto, there were two rival Jewish undergrounds that were fighting till the last day without coordination. There was a left wing and a right wing. And, you know, that's the story we don't tell ourselves about the Warsaw Ghetto, but I think we should. And so the fact that we are unbelievable at one of those peak moments of national unity and purpose, and that much of the diaspora has rediscovered its love for Israel. You know, you sometimes you don't know how much you love something until it's threatened. And suddenly, all of that angst. Now, look, we've lost a part of American Jewry. And that's a historic tragedy, even more for American Jewry than it is for Israel, because these people, for now at least, are lost to the community. They're an enemy within. Quarantined. They have to be quarantined from the mainstream Jewish Voice for Peace, if not now. And that's a tragedy because you have young Jews there who are engaged in Jewish issues, but just as in the worst possible way. So what gives me hope is that we've lost a lot less than we thought we did. There's so much love for Israel that was there just below the surface. And what we're going to need to do, and this gives me hope as well, because I believe we're now capable of doing this, is that when this war is over, American Jews and Israelis need to start having a new kind of conversation. How did we allow it to get to this point where we thought we were going to be totally alienated from each other? How, 80 years after the Holocaust, the two largest centers of Jewish life, how did we let this happen? And so, yeah.
I was going to say, we only got a minute left. So now that new conversation, I want to just say before we close, first of all, please remember that Thursday, we will be having a conversation with a wonderful individual, friend, Neil Katyal, who's going to be talking about Trump, the law, and the future of democracy. That was the former Solicitor General of the United Nations, and that will be on Thursday, which is not our usual night. The other thing, and then I want to conclude, of course, Yossi, by thanking you and saying that the other thing I really think that gives us hope is that we have thinkers and speakers and writers like yourself who are able to give us a perspective on what's going to happen and also to stiffen our spines and give us courage for what is to come. And so for all of that and for everything you do for the Jewish people and have done for many years, thank you. Thank you,
David, and back at you. Thank you.
Stay safe. Thank you, everyone.